Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
All 29 of the teams are on my list.
Everyone's on the list.
I don't have a preferred destination. Like I said, I just want to win. You know, they ask me big market, small market. I don't care. You know, I want to win. You know, and obviously whatever team, you know, I get traded to, you know, play for it that year or whatever. If I get traded, I'm not sure. But just make the best of it. And then, you know, when free agency comes, see what happens. You know, I can't tell the future, but all 29 teams are on the list.
Middays on the Score.
I kind of don't exactly believe
not
you.
Every single one.
No.
All 29.
No. I think that somebody told him that it might be better business to open it up a little bit. That's Anthony Davis, obviously the center of much of what was going on over the weekend. Here to talk about that and more is a man you find on Twitter at Vince Goodwill, because he's Vincent Goodwill, Yahoo's senior NBA writer. What's happening, Vinny? How are you?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Wonderfully. The Eastern Conference is where the action is, I think, for the last couple months of this regular season. But does it, in coming out of that Eastern Conference, have teams done enough? Have the Sixers done enough to fight with the Warriors when we eventually get our NBA Finals that we're all waiting so patiently for?
I don't think there's a Kevin Durant that grows on a tree that can be the equalizer for any of these teams. I do think that people are spring anybody that comes out of the East a little bit short. And I'm sure you guys in Chicago can relate. And I know it was a long time ago, but go look at those Bulls championship runs. Whenever they were going for three straight, that was the toughest final. That was the toughest, you know, conference final series, because it takes a lot to keep going to that well time after time again. Now, I'm not saying one of these Eastern teams is going to beat Golden State, but I do think that Milwaukee and Toronto and Philly and Boston have done enough to basically put them on a level where they can say, all right, we're in game six against the Golden State Warriors. And whether we're down 3-2 or up 3-2, but that's where we are. And I think if you can say that, you know, that's where a series should be or could be, I think basically that's all you can ask for.
How interested should a team be in trying to pull a Paul George? Like, what would it take for a team's management group to be right now, look, we're going to make a move for AD. He's going to like it so much here that we are going to convince him. We're so confident in who we are and what we do. Because, look, ownership matters. Management matters. Do you think there's a team out there that is going to say, we're going to make him love us?
I don't know if there's a team out there, but I would say, considering how scared of a league or risk-averse this league, you know, has traditionally been, you know, I would be one of those guys, if I were in somebody's front office or management group, I would be saying, hey, why can't we make a move for this guy? And just to say, and look, I don't think he was lying when he said he's open to 29 other teams. He's talking about he's open to being traded to 29 other teams, not signing with 29 other teams. I think you have to be open for that. You're not going to block a trade to one place or another. I think he's open-minded in that way of at least, you know, trying it out, seeing exactly how it's going to play, and then making his decision. If he's going to leave, he's going to leave anyway. The problem is, if you're one of these other teams, there's only so much you have in the way of assets. There's only so many decent players you have, so many draft picks you can offer, that Anthony Davis is going to be leaving the situation and walking right into the same exact, you know, locker room where there's players in there who aren't as talented as he is, or at least no one up to par that can say, I can at least get you to the second round of the NBA playoffs. Mm-hmm. That's why I think realistically there's only a handful of teams in Oklahoma City was lucky, because they had competent front office and they had Russell Westbrook, who could basically scare Paul George into staying.
Talk of basketball with Vincent Goodwill. He is at Vince Goodwill on Twitter. He's Yahoo's senior NBA writer. What from the NBA All-Star game mattered most? What one thing that didn't have to do necessarily with the hooping actually mattered to you? Was it Kyrie watching the entire acceptance speech at the end of things, Dirk hitting a couple of three-pointers? Was there one thing, one storyline that really mattered to you, that spoke to you more than anything else?
I'm not a huge SAP in that way, but I'm also not a huge conspiracy theorist that just says, you know, because Kyrie and KD were in the back hallway, you know, talking and spending a few moments together, that that was some type of sign. So I'll honestly say the stuff with Dirk and Dwayne Wade was honestly kind of, I would say, touching, because so many times when guys are considered to be washed, you know, we forget about them, we forget their contributions, and the game has changed in all these different ways, that those two guys are basically sort of pioneers in a certain way. I don't put much stock into Kyrie watching Kevin Durant's acceptance speech or Kevin Durant winning the second, you know, All-Star MVP and all these other type of things. I think we've known, you know, for a while now how great Kevin Durant is, or at least to some degree with Kyrie, what his options are. I didn't have to see anything else. But just to see, you know, the history being honored, there were times throughout the night where Bill Russell was honored, Magic Johnson was honored, and things like that. And I think the NBA does a really good job of embracing the guys who sort of paved the way. I'm just glad it did not take a long time for them to do that for Dwayne Wade and Dirk Nowitzki. They actually gave them their roses while they were still playing. And that doesn't, I know that doesn't mean anything in the future, but just saying, you know, just the way that the league comports itself and the way the league behaves relative to other sports leagues in that way, you know, I find that pretty remarkable.
We were looking at some of the television numbers recently that are down across the board. A lot of reasons for this. And as we discussed several weeks ago, it may simply be that LeBron James is not on TV early and that he's on TV too late now because of where he is, and it makes that big a difference. But the Bulls' numbers are way off because there have been eyes on them even when they had been bad, but that's not the case now. Do you think that there are any warning signs with some of these stars retiring, with a lot of future Hall of Famers closer to the end than the beginning, with all of the money that has been pumped into this? Do you think that there is Mark Cuban like to say that pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered? Is the NBA wary of some large scale business headwinds?
I don't know if they are, but I will say they would be wise to take a lesson from the NFL in that way, where ratings were high and the warning signs were around, but the money kept coming in, the revenue kept coming in, and they kind of just looked at it as carcass on the side of the road, because despite all of those things that were the evidence that was in their face, you know, the immediate dividends were still paying off. I think the NBA is a little more, I won't say paranoid, but they have to be a little more aware, because they're not that ingrained into the American consciousness the way that baseball used to be, the way that the NFL appears to be right now, even despite its issues. And you don't put that much stock into early season ratings, honestly, guys, because, and you can almost draw it to this, fewer people were watching the NFL last year, and those numbers came back to a relative order. Maybe they were watching more of the NBA. I would say I pay far more attention to the numbers from this point on to June. It's a playoff sport. They got to do, you know, the TNT promotion, 40 nights of basketball, 40 days, 40 nights, that type of thing. If those numbers are coming up short, then you got something. But because you talked about it earlier, Boston's going to be a premier team. Philadelphia, Toronto, it's maybe not Toronto because they don't register, but when you have the Northeast Corridor in the Nielsen rating, so to speak, when you have those teams being relevant, I think that means something. And if LeBron is in the playoffs, that doesn't hurt either.
Do you think that any of that, the flagging ratings early on, even though you said you expect things to pick back up, do you think any of that has to do with Adam Silver's foray into sports betting, or is that just a good business practice and good speculation of where markets are headed?
Well, I would say, if anything would be affected by that, the numbers would go up, because I think people are obsessed with the thought of gambling. I don't think people are watching less because they could go into gambling. I think people would wind up watching more. You know, I'm not a ratings expert. I don't know exactly the trends. I don't have a Nielsen box, you know, in my home. And it's funny that, you know, we give these pollsters basically so much country to some degree, and, you know, determining how many people are watching relative to actually measuring how many people are really watching. So I do think that they're trying to be forward thinking as far as new streams of revenue. You know, if you look at some of the league pass things, they're trying to give the a la carte situation and everything else. Like, they're not resting on their laurels in that way. So I would say less than the NFL. There's not that organizational arrogance that the NFL has that the NBA shouldn't have. So I think they're always wary about some doom coming around the corner. But if you look at it, I don't think people are saying, I'm not watching the NBA anymore. And if they really are, they're lying.
We always like to look at a conference-less playoff system if we seed these teams 1 through 16 and not care if they are Eastern or Western to try to get the best matchups and avoid having the understood de facto finals in the semis or even the quarters, that there would be a really cool way to just say, hey, forget conferences, we'll keep the divisions for travel purposes. Yet, it's never going to happen because the teams that would be on the outside looking in, the owners that would be looking that year or for the next couple years, the teams that are down but still in the playoffs don't want to give up the revenue they would get from those playoff games. How could we get to a more fair, modern playoff system that produces the best possible playoffs and the most worthy possible champion?
Let me ask you the question. Is the playoffs meant to find a champion, or is the playoffs meant to get the best 16 teams in?
At the moment, they're simply meant to get the top eight of each conference in, and you figure that the final four will be the final four wherever they're coming from. I mean, they'll be the best, well, like the best four players will be on their teams, right?
Well, I will say this to you. And considering you're in Chicago and I'm a native Detroiter, and I say this as if we're just two guys speaking and not as if we're talking on the radio, two guys who are presumably sports fans. I don't want 16 teams. I don't want the randomness. I don't want March Madness in the NBA. I want rivalries. I want at least the possibility of it. I want teams. Look at some of the things. The first question you asked me was, did the teams in the Eastern Conference do enough to put themselves on par with the Golden State Warriors, right? If there were no conferences, then those teams wouldn't know who to prepare for because the system would be so random, you can't go out and get a Marc Gasol in preparation for playing a Joel Embiid.
Okay.
You couldn't go out and get a Tobias Harris to go out and play a Kawhi Leonard and other wings in the conference because you can't look at anything going on with eight teams or four teams or three teams or anything else because the system would just be random. And I think we're missing that. Because we're looking at, the ninth seed in the Western Conference is a decent 46-win team, and the eighth seed in the Eastern Conference, they don't deserve to be in. They just won 41 games. To be honest, I don't give a damn. I want to see good playoffs from the second round on. It'd be great if the first round was cool, but I want to see the best eight teams. I want to see good competitive series, and I want to see the possibilities of rivalries forming and being sustainable for years to come, and not the randomness. That's just me. If you're campaigning for that, I understand it. But from my standpoint, I want familiarity breeding contempt for years to come.
I like that answer, I think it's a completely fair answer. I also would counter argue by saying I don't want my team making roster decisions and personnel decisions based on a potential second round playoff matchup. I think every team in the league should be saying, how do I beat Golden State? How do we stop Giannis? Always look at the best team, always be trying to win the championship and take on all comers.
Well, but to me, that's not realistic, because if you go back to the modern NBA, the championships are basically held by four or five franchises. And with the league being as healthy as it is, people haven't had huge problems with Lakers, Celtics, Spurs, Bulls, Pistons, or whoever, hogging the championships. Every team, every franchise, as we know it, does not have the same level of expectations. Like if you go to the Washington Wizards franchise and you ask a general fan, what do you want for your team? And they'll say, honestly, I want
the
to get to
sweet
the
release
round.
Of death will be the answer that you get from
Wizards. Yeah, right, right. Yeah. I'm just saying. But some franchises have higher expectations than the others. Every team does not have championship or bust. So when you're talking about success and you're talking about everybody having a chance, to me that's not realistic. This isn't the NFL. Like, I guess I accept the world in which I live in and that the NBA is completely different than other sports in that way, and that certain franchises are going to hold the championships and that is basically going to be between whoever those four contenders of that year or of that period are going to be. What teams make the best moves? Not 2019 trying to catch Golden State. I'd rather it be three or four trying to catch Golden State, because if you go pick a year, let's say pick 1993. I could name every title contender from 1993 or any year on, and it's only three to four every year. Not necessarily the teams that make the conference finals, but just three to four championship caliber teams with championship expectations chasing the Bulls or chasing the Lakers or chasing whoever that really have a shot at winning. And I think the league is healthy that way. You don't need 29 great teams. You just need a handful of good ones and a few great ones that are separate.
Speaking of expectations and hogging championships, or at least championship appearances, LeBron and the Lakers have enough to get themselves into a spot to maybe make some noise in the Western Conference playoffs or not?
Yeah, by noise, do we mean like, you know, like appearance?
I guess you could define noise if you wanted to, but I want them to win a round. Let's say win a round.
Okay, here's the scenario in which I believe that they win a round.
Uh-huh.
Is there any other seed besides eighth?
Yeah.
Because if they get an eighth seed and they're playing Golden State, they're going home early. Now, if they're a seventh seed, I will ascribe to the theory of LeBron James. You got to beat him four times in 2 weeks. And the only team that has actually done that over the past half decade has been the Spurs and Golden State. So I wouldn't be afraid if I were the Lakers going into Oklahoma City or going into Denver, and Denver not having the relative experience, you know, playoff experience, even though they have a lot of talent and a lot of good players. So, yeah, to me, that would be the ideal scenario for basketball fans, like a 2-7 Denver, L.A., or 2-7 Oklahoma City and the Lakers. That's the way I see them winning the playoffs. As long as he's of relative health and the Lakers are not falling apart at the seams, I don't want to see that guy.
Vincent, this is always fun. We appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
Hey, no problem, guys. Take it easy.
That is Vince Goodwill, the NBA senior writer for Yahoo. Got Sahadev Sharma coming up in a little bit with the latest on the Cubs. And we've already talked a lot so far, starting out this show. I actually grudgingly at some point have to say some nice things about St. Louis.
You got a love letter to write to a city that you previously couldn't stand.
There are a couple aspects of it that were awesome.
We'll write some things out. We can hand deliver it to Chris Bryant when we hit Cubs camp in about 2 weeks.
Also, you mentioned Bruce Bochy before.
I did.
I had no idea that he still has what might be an unbeatable MLB record.
An unbeatable one?
As a player.
Oh, I didn't know that either. We've got baseball trivia and Dan writes a love letter. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
In my mind, it's time. You know, I've managed with my gut. You know, I came up here in 2007 on my gut. And so it's a gut feeling that it's time, and it's been an unbelievable ride. And there's so much, you know, to be grateful for, you know, with the players, the city, the fans, you know, my ride here. It's time now.
How old is Bruce Bochy?
I don't know, but he's a real-life Lou Brown.
How old is he?
I got to see a guy about some white walls.
Talk to you later.
Yeah, he's on the phone. He's got to go. Oh, my God. I forgot Bruce Bochy was a real-life Lou Brown.
63.
Oh, okay. That is the oldest-sounding 63-year-old man. That is, like, could he sound more? Like you say, that's
he's
old
seen
man.
War. No, he has seen it all.
I'm too old. I'm too old to go diving into lockers. We're out of towels.
He's the old half of a buddy cop film.
Right. I mean, God, does he sound old.
That's awesome.
But good old. That's great.
He's the kind of old you'd cast in a Western.
Right. It isn't like the Tony La Russa old coot guy.
No.
He was saying this, and I'm saying this. That's
the old guy in the Western you come across who's been out in the frontier too long. Yeah. Just kind of alone in a cabin. Or like the guy, like the commanding officer at the post that Costner comes across and shoots himself before he heads off into the frontier.
Or
that guy. That was La Russa.
Barry Corbin as the old man in No Country for Old Men.
Sure.
Remember, he just sort of in that cabin alone by himself with a rusted coffee pot. But wow. Now, Bruce Bochy, he says he manages with his gut. He should manage with his head.
Okay.
Because that is an all-time record. He wore His hat size, he wears, his hat size is 8 1/8.
That's an enormous noggin.
And I don't know if total fully horse steroid Barry Bonds with the brow ridges and the shifting tectonic plates ever ballooned past this, or maybe Ken Griffey in The Simpsons. But 8 1/8, the largest head in MLB. Kevin Mensch, apparently?
Kevin Mensch had an 8, and I know he was an 8 for sure, at least 8.
Okay, because
Kevin Mensch had a huge head. His nickname was Shrek.
At the time, they had to special order his helmet. He had one batting helmet, and when Bochy got traded or went to a different team, he had to bring his helmet like a little leaguer.
It's amazing.
For repainting.
I didn't know
that. It would
that.
Be repainted and repurposed. They couldn't just get him a helmet because he had his own mixing bowl that he had to wear on his head to protect it.
So if he'd gone to the 60s Yankees, it would have had to be flocked.
Oh, you better flock the hell out of that.
It would have been a personalized flocking.
Oh, you gotta flock it and flock it good.
How much flocking would that be?
That'd be just nonstop flocking.
Bruce, you're not playing today. We ran out of flocking materials.
Yeah,
we can't be out there. We don't have a helmet for you.
Your helmet is not properly flocked, so go flock yourself. So after 3 days in St. Louis, and look, here's the thing. I'm still going to make fun of St. Louis sports fans. I love making fun of goofy St. Louis sports fans. But I have to say, there were three things in that city that were great. And we always have fun.
When's the last time you went?
Oh, I hadn't been to St. Louis since I covered a Bears-Rams game.
So that's a while ago.
Yeah. Like 20 years.
Right? Yeah, so that starts with a 9, right? That's the 90s?
Yeah, it was the Wanstead Bears that were playing in a meaningless end-of-season game. I'll never forget being right in the tunnel as they come off the field. And they won, but it was weird. Like, nobody wanted to be there, and neither team was trying. And I remember Todd Berger, he's walking off, and I looked at Todd Berger like, what the hell was that? And he goes, I don't know.
The last game of the year?
It was either the last game or a last game.
Penultimate or last.
Yeah, it was clear. No, there were no fans there, and neither team wanted to be there. And like the Bears, I don't think they wanted to win, but they ended up winning. And I literally asked, I was like, what the hell was that? I don't know.
Last time I was there was Cubs Cardinals in 15 for the NLDS. And you know how baseball trips are, at least for a series anyway. You're either at the hotel or you're at the ballpark. You don't really have a chance to go anywhere else because you're writing and filing and doing all sorts of reporting and whatnot. So I didn't really get to see the city at that point, but I did walk from one end of downtown to another, from the hotel to the ballpark. I didn't see the marvels that you're talking about, though. I wasn't beguiled by the wonder of the city.
One thing we saw were some way better hockey teams than we were. Yeah. That's one thing.
You're going to have that.
Yeah, they didn't tell you. I think we kind of got duped into being in this tournament because they might have needed another bantam team to
sandbag you a little bit.
Yeah, as in all the other teams are AA travel. But some really nice kids, some really nice coaches, some great, really valuable experience playing against some sensational competition there. And it was, I had no idea it was such a hockey town. They've got like 12 rinks in the metro area of St. Louis.
Has it always been a big youth hockey?
I guess
so. Is it burgeoning?
No, it's always been that way.
Always been. They're
tight with the Blues, and they've got the junior Blues programs there.
Well, I knew the interest in the Blues has always been very, very high. I didn't know that the actual playing of the sport was.
It's a big hockey town. And here's the deal, though. Three things that were absolutely awesome. This city museum is not what you think it is. It's called City Museum. It's not a museum.
It's a fight club.
It's a sort of phantasmagoric, interactive, physically challenging, mentally stimulating art installation that has multiple bars in it.
What?
I mean, there's slides and ladders and whole parkour areas and fish tanks, and it's impossible to explain. My son was there, but couldn't really adequately explain it from his class trip from a couple of years ago. Like, oh yeah, it's fine. You go, you climb on stuff. I'm like, dude, this is unreal.
Oh my
like,
God,
I could spend hours in there. It's like conceived by this crazy architect designer builder in an old shoe factory, and they kept the old shoelace weaving machines, and they still make custom shoelaces there. It's amazing. So they just let the machine still work.
How old a shoe factory is this? Is this like...
It goes back to like the 20s? 30s. Or yeah, your 20s okay. or something. It's a, and there's like event spaces in there and giant slides and outdoor tunnels. And it's
Did you guys visit a thing called Toddler Town Castle? Because on the website now it says, now open, yeah, Toddler Town Castle.
We walked by there and I poked my head in, but I realized that those things are generally also Field of Germs. So
covered in urine.
Yes, covered. There's not enough sanitizer in the world to get me into like a, that's the equivalent of like a McDonald's play place.
Yeah,
the other thing I will say nice about St. Louis, the Budweiser tour is great.
You're kidding.
It was great.
Enjoyed it. Were they very adamant about not using corn syrup in all of their beer, in any of their beer?
No.
Really?
Not on the tour, but they...
That's been part of their marketing push.
It's great. I learned a lot and got to sample. They're not shy on the sampling.
Well, that's always kind.
And they own everything. It's not just Budweiser. So when you finish up, you sample Bud and Bud Light and Bud Light Platinum. There's a new Bud Light Orange that they gave us.
Did you see the actual stills?
Did you see everything.
If I remember right, the Budweiser brewery stills are the largest ones in the world.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly.
Well, the one tank, there's a tank that we saw that was the mixing tank? I forgot which one it was. But they said, do you think, what would it take to drink one of these in your lifetime? And they said, if you drank a beer every hour of every day for like 130 years, you could drink like half of it or something. It was some ridiculous number.
But challenge accepted.
Yep.
We got to meet the Clydesdales.
Yeah.
In their pens. And
how many Clydesdales are there?
A lot. There's a lot of Clydesdales. Some were out on assignment, so we didn't get to see all of them. But enough Clydesdales were there. And there's some very proud...
Big old horses, huh?
Oh, very proud Clydesdales.
I see.
Yes.
I see.
There's one horse...
They knew they were on show.
Yeah, there's one horse there named Bruce. And Bruce is that's all man right there, and he just standing there.
My God, sir!
Yeah, the kids on the team are like, "Wow, that's why they call it horse bleep." I'm like, "Yes,
yes." Don't say that out loud. That's for hockey practice.
That's why
we don't say that here at the City Museum or at the Budweiser
that's
tour.
Why it's called horse bleep.
Those words are for hockey practice.
Yes, that was a thing. But no, it was a really cool tour, and they afterward, I got to sample a vanilla porter I had never tried that was excellent. And also, if you go to St. Louis, Sugar Fire Barbecue. It's called, there's a couple of locations. There's their main smokehouse. And I know they've been on like Food Network and Travel Channel. They've won a bunch of competitions.
Right.
Sugar Fire has something called the Meat Daddy.
It's old.
Okay.
Yep.
It's a platter. You order the Meat Daddy. I literally didn't eat until dinner the next day.
Sounds like Bruce would have enjoyed that as well.
Oh, that would be easy. The Meat Daddy was pulled pork, brisket, smoked turkey, ribs, and a jalapeno cheddar sausage, smoked.
Clammers!
and three sides.
Make sure you de-stick those ribs.
It was three sides. And I had a straight shot of Jack Daniels with
them. Oh, hell yeah.
Because
let it ride.
Right.
Because they'll let it ride.
They said, what do you want? They said, do you want a bourbon-infused milkshake? Because that's their specialty.
Okay.
And I said, no, I just like a neat shot of Jack.
Give me the liquor. Thank you.
We're going to throw this down. And oh, my God. Really, really, really good. All right. Let's talk a little bit of baseball, or a lot of baseball, with Sahadev Sharma, who covers the Cubs for The Athletic. He's next on The Score.
That's a pretty easy question to answer. We don't have any more. The fact is that, we've been in the top five in baseball spend for the last 5 or 6 years. We're in the top couple in spending last year. We've put our money back on the field. Unfortunately, you just can't have a high-profile free agent every single year.
You can. You actually can.
But I
understand it. It's a business, and you don't want to spend all the money all the time. I get it. But the truth is you can. You just don't want to. Here to talk about the Cubs is the guy who covers them as well or better than anyone else. He is Sahadev Sharma of The Athletic. He is on Twitter @SahadevSharma and in Mesa with the Cubs. How are you, Sahadev?
I'm doing well, surviving out here, hopefully getting to some baseball eventually, but some important topics being covered otherwise.
Well, what's most important to you baseball-wise right now? What should we be talking about first thing on in baseball?
Oh, man. I mean, I think primarily for the team's success, it's between Darvish and Bryant, the health of them. Bryant is adamant that he's healthy. Darvish is obviously healthy, but also needs to just perform. So for Darvish, it's more about I want to see in-game action and really see when the pressure's on, when he hits a bad moment, how he reacts, when the fans turn on him perhaps and he walks a guy and there's boo birds, how does he react, stuff like that. Bryant, I just want to see him really just let's see him drive the ball. And once he does that, then I'm convinced that he's fine and everything will go forward because I know how talented he is. I know how good he is. As long as that shoulder is not an issue.
So, out of one of the things that Tom Ricketts said yesterday concerning the money that's available is that Theo sees every penny coming in and out of the organization. So, if that's true, and I have no reason to believe it's not, it kind of brings to mind a question about whether or not something went wrong with the finances for this team, whether or not something didn't come online or finances aren't available, funds didn't come around. Theo's the guy who plotted out when pitching John Lester his contract that Jason Hayward would be in the outfield. Those things were done in advance, or at least thought about in advance. This offseason doesn't seem to have played out that way. Do you have any sense that something went wrong in the finances, that there isn't money available anymore?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like something did. There's no concrete answer there. We haven't gotten anything to suggest that this went awry in some way. But, I mean, we know that the TV deal has taken much longer than expected. We know that there's no upfront money with that right now when there was supposed to be. And they thought, so, I mean, I think that's a big part of it. These, you know, everything going on around Wrigley is money being invested in the team, per se. But that's not how stuff that, you know, that's not stuff fans want to hear. They want, when you talk about investing in the team, they want to see players at it. So it's hard to, you know, reconcile those things for fans especially, and I understand that. There's something there that I think changed in the, I don't know if it was simply, you know, Darvish and Chatwood issues led to Cole Hamels being added, and because of that uncertainty, they felt forced to pick up his option, and that kind of limited them. But even if that's the case, being so frugal, being so tight with everything that you couldn't even add someone like Zach Britton or Adam Ottavino or even talk to them. They were never in those discussions because they didn't have a chance, because they couldn't spend $10 million a year on a reliever. They had to wait out the process and hope that what happened, which is, you know, the market has been so slow that they were able to get guys on the massive deals. And that's fine. But for me, my issue with that is when you are in the middle of a window of contention, obvious window, you know you're contending right now, you have obvious flaws, I don't think you should be picking from the final guys that are remaining that are willing to take deals at a lower cost. I think you should be picking from the guys that you think are the best players available and adding them to your roster, to making sure you have a stout and deep bullpen.
Can David Bodie play short?
Yeah, he can play there. Let's wait and see. You really want to see that lateral quickness and be able to have the nice hands. He's quick. Like he has good reaction. I remember that at third base, second base. I don't recall seeing that type of range that you want to see from a shortstop. But I don't think he's going to be, you know, just terrible out there.
He's not Daniel Murphy.
No.
Okay.
And that's, I mean, that was tough to watch, right? I mean, I think really watching Murphy helped a lot of us put stuff in perspective of just how, you know, Ben Zobrist is a solid, smart second baseman. He knows how to play that. I think Bodie is similar at a younger age, so he has a little more, he's a little quicker, and he's even better defensively. I'm curious to see how it is. You know, he's basically the backup guy. I think they want to create depth and versatility. I don't think this is something that you need to be too concerned about, in the sense that, David Bodie's going to be playing multiple times a week at shortstop. If that happens, then, you know, we're talking about injuries and depth issues that just shouldn't have arisen.
Were you at all surprised that Ricketts did not have many thoughts at all about labor relations and its state of play in Major League Baseball? Or was that just a big, long no comment made by one of the principal larger owners in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think owners know that if they talk too much about it, they're going to get themselves in dangerous waters. They know something. The players aren't happy. They shouldn't be crowing about how this is working for them. I think it's interesting that he's going to say, well, the salaries are going down. You have to count Robinson Cano's suspension added to that. I mean, now you're just like finding little nitpicking things to swing things your way. It's clear what's happening here. I don't know why we have to pretend that it's not a major issue. And players are voicing their opinions. Even if there's not an issue, even if you strongly feel like everything's fine, the players don't, and that's a major problem. So that's going to lead to labor unrest, and it's not what the fans want. So you can't pretend that nothing's going on when people are being very vocal about how upset they are and how things are not good, and that players may walk out and strike it at some point, whether that's now or 3 years from now. It's something that you need to consider and be aware of and acknowledge.
We know that Tommy Hotovy is not shy about using every modality at his disposal to try to monitor and supplement his pitchers. We know every team is bragging about having their Rapsodo camera systems in place to measure every little bit of everything. Are you learning how he's translating it? How all of this is actually being taught? Have you actually gotten to see it be taught or hear players talk about it?
Yeah, no, I'm working on something, so I don't want to give all the details away. But it's interesting because, like you said, you have to kind of translate it. You have to. It's not a everyone's the same type instance where here's how I'm going to teach it and you all have to learn it the same way. Everybody needs different information. Some guys, this data that pops out of there tells them that these pitches aren't being used properly, essentially, right? But they've been having success. Do you want to put that in someone's head? I had one pitcher say, hey, I heard that the way I use this pitch isn't right, but I've always had success with that. I'm not sure if I want it in my head that, wait, I'm supposed to be throwing it here, but I've always done here, and it's always worked for me. I think part of it is you want to, maybe it's not ideal, but with human beings, with players, it's hard to make changes until you start failing.
Right.
So it's just like Quintana last year not using the changeup. They were trying to get him to use the changeup, but until he really hit the skids and realized I need to make changes, it was hard for him to do that. Guys have, you're not confident in the pitch and you kind of dumped it. There's a reason you did that. So it's hard to kind of get over that mental hurdle. But yes, there's a lot of different guys that I've talked to. They're all learning in different ways. They all go in this pitch lab that they have and they have different days where they throw there and it spits out all the data. And how they use it and how it's given to them is different for all of them.
So, there was over the weekend a little bit of conversation back and forth with Joe Maddon, some of you guys down there, about Wilson Contreras' workload, how often he caught, how many times in a week he caught, and arguing about what four in a row is and isn't or something. Can you clear some of that up for us a little bit and just determine what the issue at hand was and how much Wilson was actually gassed last season versus just bad?
Yeah, no, I think so. Here's what I took away from that. He's not going to go away from using him as his everyday catcher, like how you would the best catchers in baseball. I think he made a good point, and I'm not sure if he realized he was making the good point, but go look at the best catchers in baseball. They were all hurt last year,
yeah.
So they didn't rack up innings. So when we look at how many innings Wilson Contreras had and how much more it was than the next guy, well, Real Muto missed a month. Molina, I believe Molina was hurt. Gary Sanchez was hurt. Buster Posey was hurt. These are the best guys that rack up the innings most years. So Wilson Contreras is supposed to be in that category. So you need to figure out, is he mentally fatigued? Is he physically fatigued? Is it? I honestly think it was part of the puzzle, yes. But I really think he put too much pressure on himself, and a lot of it was mental and how he channeled his energy. This guy has a ton of energy, and I think the frustration led to that energy coming out in ways that you just don't want it to come out. It wasn't an efficient use of that energy, if that makes sense. So he needs to figure out a way, and I think he's working on it, to channel that energy better and more productively. And I think we know how good he is. We know how talented he can be, the performance he can put up. I do think a little drop in innings would be ideal. But if Joe's going to ride him as a catcher, 120 starts is probably fine.
And how about learning how to frame a pitch? I'd be more interested in that than the total number of innings. You know, help your pitchers out a little bit, dude.
Yeah, he doesn't seem – it's not that he's not working on it. It's hard. I think he doesn't like to talk about it with us, so it comes off as dismissive. And I think people get the impression that he doesn't care or that he's not working on that. I think he works on that. I know Borzy is big on that. Mike Borzello mm-hmm. Is working with him on all those things. And you know what? I think it's more important that if he's not going to talk to us about it and get into details about it, that's fine. I know that he's working on it with Borzello. I've talked to Borzello about that. It's something that they work on. And, if Borzello and Contreras sometimes battle about it, that's fine. But eventually he'll relent and he listens to Borzello.
Sahadev, thanks for always being available for us, man.
Of course. Thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
Sahadev Sharma of The Athletic covering the Cubs. We have the Midday Midway coming up. I have stoned dolphins, and I have an entire city that decided to work together to be quiet.
A video game fire festival in a galaxy far, far away gets just a little bit closer. The Midday Midway is next, 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.